Swan. He has no other name. His past is a mystery, but his work is already a legend. He wrote and produced his first gold record at 14. In the years since then, he has won so many others that he once tried to deposit them in Fort Knox. He brought the blues to Britain. He brought Liverpool to America. He brought folk and rock together. His band, the Juicy Fruits, single-handedly gave birth to the nostalgia wave of the 70s. Now he is looking for the new sound of the Spheres to inaugurate his own Xanadu, his own Disneyland. The paradise, the ultimate rock palace. This film is the story of that search, of that sound, of the man who made it, the girl who sang it, and the monster who stole it.
Welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and as usual, to my left in another dimension is Jason.
Good evening, good day, good morning, whatever it might be.
And I say it's another dimension because I hear it's actually sunny and warm where you live.
It is, oddly enough. You know, it's funny you say that because I went to get my car washed today, which I don't do that often because, you know, where I live with the parking, within 2 or 3 days, the sprinklers are out and you just, you know, ruins the car anyway. But it was time. You know, it was time. And it was chilly. And someone started chatting to me about the wind and how chilly it was, who happened to actually be from Canada, by the way, and was saying, you know, how chilly. And I thought, yeah, you know, when did this happen that I'm actually kind of getting chills and it's like 55 degrees out? This is kind of nice. It feels seasonal because tomorrow it could be 85.
You know, that's funny you say that because your friend of mine, Mark Huckabone, was in town.
Oh yeah,
from LA, and we were walking to a restaurant one night, and he started going, "Oh my God, it's so cold!" And actually, it wasn't that cold an evening. And I had to turn to him and say, "You're from Chicago."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, you know what? California, it changes you." And,
but he's been out here like 5 minutes.
Well, I think it's been a decade.
It has not been a decade.
Well,
has it?
It, yeah, I think so.
If it is, then why is it I see the guy more at Comic-Con than I do in the city we live in?
I couldn't tell you, but I do know that this show is off to a great start with insider tales and car wash stories.
This episode is all about Mark Huckabone.
Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway, I just you know how my brain works. It, yep. You bring it out of me. It's your fault. I can't help it.
I'm sorry I did that.
Yes. But anyway, what are we doing here today? What's the topic? Have we come
Today's
up with a topic?
Topic is, I think, somebody that not necessarily just inherently 70s, but definitely somebody who is known to children of the 70s and one of the more iconic personalities of our generation, and that is Rod Serling.
Yes, and I want to jump in right away and let anyone out there listening know that this was my idea. So what I mean is he's not necessarily within the wheelhouse of a lot of the stuff that we talk about, which tends to be kind of, you know, late 60s to, you know, mid 80s kind of stuff. But I started to think that he truly is a hero of mine. I don't have a long list of heroes, but he's one of them. And I started to think about, well, you know, the show Twilight Zone, for example, was a staple and still is, you know, 50 years later. It was of my childhood and I think a lot of people's childhoods.
Yeah.
You know, Night Gallery, I have memories of, you know, when some of it aired as a little kid being kind of freaked out and scared by that. But his legend looms large. And what's great about doing this or what we're going to talk about is just all the little pockets of for a guy that started out very much in the realism realm of what his writing was, to become so synonymous with so much genre stuff, which we'll get to. He is, I think, a true geek hero, not just a hero to non-geeks and writers and, you know, whatever, but I think to a lot of us, he is one of the guys.
Absolutely. I have friends who are not, you know, they don't, they wouldn't go to a comic book movie if you saved their, if the, their house is on fire.
Right.
You know, they don't watch anything particularly geeky. They own guns and like hunting, but the Twilight Zone box sets in their house.
Right.
You know, I think he crosses borders. My own dad, who's not particularly a geek, I believe the Twilight Zone was one of the reasons his parents ever bought a television in the late '50s.
That's interesting.
Because he was always going over to a friend's house to watch TV, and my grandparents said, well, maybe we ought to get one so he's not freeloading. And it was, you know, my dad liked watching The Twilight Zone.
Well, what's incredible about it, and we're gonna start over here again, start from scratch, and we'll get to his backstory.
But oh, sure.
What's amazing about Twilight Zone, you know, is it is so head and shoulder. If you look at a lot of the other content from the same time, the same period of television, it is so far out in front. It is such an anomaly, and it's remarkable in some ways that it has held up the way that it has. I think it's a testament to anything that, you know how much I love the Beatles. They're like my religion. I keep saying that, but
yeah,
it's like
you mentioned it once.
There's not, but there really isn't. There's not like a formula that says why exactly. We all know how those planets lined up and the zeitgeist and, you know, the right time and all these things and the quality and so on. But why it all gelled in that way that those guys, I mean, what I'm saying is that whoever's number two, whoever, whatever band or act or artist you want to pick are such a distant second that, you know, they need to be talked about with all the other folks. Like they're just way out there. Well, Twilight, I look at the planets lining up for Serling and Twilight and this show and, I think there's I don't know exactly why, but there must be some discernible reason that it resonated and has done for 50 years, and it has to do with the concept and the writing, and still how effective it is. But anyway, we should start from, you know, from the beginning. We're not going to get the guy's life story. This isn't this is your life, Rod Serling. But anybody can look his details up and, you know, what kind of writer he was and where he came from and everything, and he did a lot of radio. And then eventually, you know, someone kind of put the bug in his ear, like, you've got to get to New York. That's where it's at. And he went to New York like in the mid 50s and became this the young man of the writing world and eventually of Hollywood, where he was a, you know, World War II veteran. He saw things in his time in the service. I think he was a paratrooper, maybe. I forget. People should know this as well. I've said this before on Geek Shell and Hair at the other show. We do this. I'm in Los Angeles. Brian is in where are you again?
That's a good question.
Brian is in a confidential location.
A secret bunker with Dick
secret
Cheney.
Bunker underground with a white mailbox out front.
Yep.
But you know, we do this stuff out of our heads. What I don't mean we're all messed up when we do it. I mean that we're on computers, but we're not looking stuff up.
So, I currently am.
Oh, you are? Okay. But yeah. If I get stuff wrong, I'm gonna get stuff wrong because this is all just coming out of my brain and, you know, stream of consciousness. But anyway, so he goes to New York, and these experiences in the war really, in many ways, sort of seeped into everything he wrote, or much of what he wrote. He was very anti-war. He was very much for equality, civil rights. There's a lot of it. We can get to all that. But
he's a very progressive thinker, and I think that's why a lot of the Twilight Zone is still considered relevant, is because, yes, you know, for the era of like the time, he was talking about things that let's see, Make Room for Daddy wasn't. You know?
Yes, absolutely. And he, what's interesting about it is his experiences lead to the writing. It leads to the praise, some of the subject matter, but also inadvertently, the things he was writing about led to Twilight Zone, because he was doing things. He did one of the most famous things. He did like Playhouse 90. They did these live, you know, adaptations of his stuff. It was called Patterns. And it was about big business in New York and how a guy that's been at this company for 30 years but is kind of running dry with ideas is being sort of ushered out for the new guy. And it's a merciless thing. Requiem for a Heavyweight, he did.
Yeah.
Another one, which I think had to do with
boxing.
Well, Heavyweight was about boxing. But another one was like A Town Has Turned to Dust, I think it was called. And it was about racism or something. But for example, you know, he would have lots of combative meetings with the censors or the sponsors of the show. And famously, there are two things that he's talked about, he did talk about, and that are certainly out there for people to look up. One was, I forget which play it was, but one character turns to another and says, "Can I get a match?" They're having a cigarette, and he says, "Can I get a match?" And because the sponsor of the show was Ronson Lighters, they stepped in and wanted that line removed. Give him a lighter, like, or something. And it was, I know it seems minor, but that's the kind of thing that would really irk Serling. Another one was something to do with the Holocaust, I believe. And the sponsor was GE Gas Ovens. And so they were either going to lose sponsorship or he had to change the topic of the show. So because of that interference, there's a very famous interview with him and Mike Wallace in 1959, just before this new series called Twilight Zone launches. And Mike Wallace says, he mentions the controversy, he mentions the censorship, he mentions the sponsors, and Serling is saying, "I don't want to have those fights anymore." You know, I can't do a Serling impression, but I wish I could.
Yeah.
But he says, "I don't want to have those fights anymore. I, you know, it's not worth it. It drains me and everything." And so this new show you've got, this new series that's going to air in a few weeks called The Twilight Zone. This is something that there won't be anything controversial in this or anything topical or any of those avenues. And Serling, without missing a beat, he's like, No. This is an anthology series. This is a fantasy science fiction sort of a anthology show, and we won't be doing that at all. And the brilliance of Twilight Zone, like some of Star Trek, which we've talked about in the topics, is that he used the format of fantasy and science fiction to get all that stuff across that he wanted to in his usual writing. You know, anti-war, you know, nuclear war, racism, you name it. It's all in there, but nobody noticed and nobody cared because they just thought it was a fantasy series. So that's pretty genius. And so that you know, the war influences the subject matter, the depth of the subject matter gets into controversy with the things I mentioned, which turns into Twilight Zone, where he had free reign. It's also – I'm rambling, I know, but it's also one of the few shows – you know, you and I have talked about Doctor Who. How it's one of the most genius concepts, whichever way it was done, whoever was in the lead, because they could take it anywhere. Because the machine can travel in time and space,
right.
It wouldn't be absurd to do an Ancient Rome episode 1 week, and then the following week you could be in, you know, Andromeda Galaxy, whatever. Well, Twilight Zone could go just about anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, they had comedy episodes, they had Western episodes, they had episodes with just one person in them. You know, they had science fiction, they had horror. I mean, it really could go anywhere it wanted to.
And a lot of people flock to it for its O. Henry twist endings. But moreover that, there was usually a real message in those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good message.
Let's get personal now.
All right.
You know, I'll hit you with this. When do you recall... Because was it a staple of local television when you grew up, or like the
not immediately. I'd heard of it because my dad would make reference to it. You know, like, you know how your parents just say things and you go, "I don't know what that is." And so I remember my dad talking about the Twilight Zone, you know, but he'd never, you know, follow up on it. It started showing up, I think, on Channel 29 after school when I was about 10 or 11, and it became. Okay. They played an hour of it, and it became a staple with me and my friends. I would race home to watch it. And,
really?
Oh, yeah. I was – because I'd never seen it. And I can remember, too, you know, like this is a show that – like this is, what, 1980, 1981? So the show is well over 20 years old and black and white and old-timey. There are still episodes that scared the living crap out of me, you know.
Well, isn't that – well, That's my next question was going to be, well, just to go back, I should have said this. The show premiered in 1959. So that's the first season. And there were half hour episodes until the fourth season, which the ratings were so good for CBS, they wanted it to expand it to an hour. There's gold in that fourth season, but there's no denying that you watching an hour long episode of Twilight Zone is a much different animal than watching that 30-minute format. And
don't like them.
They're like, it's kind of like a different show sometimes.
Yeah.
And then of course its final season, its fifth season, it was a back to a half hour. But it's interesting. So was that one of your first experiences with something black and white?
Oh, heck no.
Okay.
I grew up on the Little Rascals after school and the old George Reeves Supermans. And you know, I watched lots of black and white television. Definitely wasn't a turnoff for me at all. But I think the thing that kept me going back to it was A, they had a lot of science fictional themes.
Mm-hmm.
And B was the shock kind of endings, the twist, the being scared. I don't know if I could get my kids to sit down and watch it, but I certainly was. It certainly made me a lifelong fan. And I have friends growing up in this neck of the woods that are, like I said, lifelong fans of the Twilight Zone.
I think when it hits you at a certain age, and I think I'm safe to say, you know, 7-8 years old for me. Because I had older brothers. I mean, I still do, but I had older brothers that were, you know, going on 10 years older than me. That, you know, a lot of stuff was inherited from them, or I got turned on to certain music because of them, or what have you. And then, you know, certainly the same with television. But if it hit you at a certain age, you know, 7, 8, 9, whatever it was, I do think it's sort of, it's unsettling. Some of it can be very unsettling because you don't know quite how to take this. And I mean, the first episode, because this makes me, sometimes I think about Monty Python the same way, like they would run Holy Grail, you know, on public television. I must have been 8, 9 years old, 7, 8, 9 years old, seeing it the first time. And some of it genuinely disturbed me. I couldn't figure out why that was funny, because it was so dirty and grimy the way it was done that it scared me. Twilight Zone, for the first thing that comes to mind, and I know it's a very famous episode, and we'll get to the toys, you know, later that Biff Bang Pow did, but this episode called Eye of the Beholder. Do you remember that one?
Of course, yeah.
When that ending hit, and the very first time I saw it, I mean, that gave me nightmares. The images of those doctors and nurses, that whatever that makeup was, that pig face thing.
They're freaky.
It really disturbed me. I mean, and by the way, this show is going to be filled with spoilers if none of you out there have seen The Twilight Zone.
why are you listening if you haven't?
Yeah, stop listening now. We're going to give the ending away to every Twilight Zone episode ever made. There's some really genuinely disturbing images throughout that series that still, I think, are effective if you put it down in front of somebody for the first time, but especially as kids. Don't you think?
Oh, yeah. The one I remember perfectly is my dad and I were outside playing a board game, like backgammon or something. Uh-huh. And he said, oh, go get me a Coke. And I went downstairs and I turned on the TV to see which Twilight Zone I was missing.
Uh-huh.
And I shit you not, it was Shatner on the plane lifting up the little shade, and the face was there, and I fell over. Because, you know, I was squatting just checking it out, and I fell over. I turned off the TV, and I ran upstairs. I got my dad a Coke, and I was like, oh, yeah, I was watching this guy in the plane. And my dad goes, oh, yeah, that's like a gremlin. And it's like, up the wing. And it's like, oh, you've seen that one? You know, and it took me years to see it, finally.
When you watch the gremlin episode, what's funny about that is of any of the creatures, and, you know, it was, you know, Outer Limits took a page out of Twilight Zone's book, and certainly ran with it and did some really, really great stuff.
I love the designs on that show.
Oh, they're brilliant. But it sort of started to get known as the monster of the week thing. They were much more known for the monsters than Twilight Zone was. What's interesting is, for the most part, I mean, there's some dated stuff in Twilight Zone, of course, but the gremlin has to be the most dated thing.
It's pretty goofy looking.
It's really goofy. And yet that scene, what you just described, is still disturbing. It's still weird thing to it's the context of what this thing was. The brilliance of and we'll get to some specific episodes here because I'd love to of the format was, and Serling, you know, by the way, this was really mind-blowing. He narrated the show, obviously.
Yes.
And he opened and closed it on camera. And it was, he was never had aspirations, and I don't think he ever, he was, they say he was always incredibly stressed and nervous doing those on-camera things. Like, he would sweat through two or three shirts just trying to do those opens and closes.
And he, if you've noticed, he never could put down his cigarettes.
No, exactly. He's always smoking. And he smoked, I think, like 3 packs a day.
Yeah, he was a real, like, lighting his cigarette with the other cigarette.
Yes.
Type of guy. And eventually, I think that's what killed him, is, you know.
Well, we'll get to that. But definitely that was a big part of it. But he was tenacious. You know, he's one of these guys that you felt probably never just sat down and relaxed.
Well, one of the things I read about Serling, and I can't remember where I read it, but at a very early age, his parents would encourage him to talk. Uh-huh. And I think it was an interview. Whoever wrote this interviewed his brother and said, "Oh, car rides were hell," because Rod would talk for 5 hours, you know. And his parents were very supportive, and obviously, he had a gift for talking and mm-hmm. a gift for, you know, creating. But it was, he had a spark.
Yeah, and there's something. I mean, like, look, he was not a tall guy. There was something strangely kind of darkly handsome about the guy, but he was not the best looking guy. His nose had been broken twice. His mouth was kind of in a constant, you know, smirk, or kind of that flat. But he had this voice that was so distinctive. I mean, everybody knows it, of course.
Yeah.
And he also, speaking of, you know, giving it a voice, you know, I think there were 150 some episodes in total of the show. He wrote like 92 episodes.
Yeah.
I mean, so, and it's another reason I think why the show is so synonymous with Serling, is that it came out of his brain. You know, he created it. He was the host. He narrated it and oversaw it, but he wrote the bulk of the series.
It's his recipe.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it's an incredible freaking recipe. And the thing that I always find remarkable, and I can never stop talking about this guy and what he did, not just the show, but the man responsible. How many times have either in its own guise, you know, as the Twilight Zone or some other type of anthology series, how many times have people tried to recapture that spirit or that flame that the Twilight Zone had? And they always fall incredibly short of getting near the quality of that show and that O. Henry, you know, twist that you're talking about. Like, what would be the next thing you could think of that would be like, you know, that was just as good as, or nearly as good as Twilight. I mean, maybe Outer Limits would be next.
Outer Limits was mostly straight science fiction, and often they weren't really trying to go for that shock ending. Like, some of them, they're, you know, Outer Limits at its best, like right. Demon with a Glass Hand or yeah. The Man Who Was Never Born. So certain stories, I think, are just as good as The Twilight Zone. But there's a lot that, you know, there isn't that many Outer Limits I would put up against The Twilight Zone.
But no, you're right. It's a different animal. And so, yeah. Again, that goes back to the uniqueness. I mean, I think people sometimes put them in the same basket, but they're very different shows. And that, again, speaks to the uniqueness of Twilight Zone and what he did with that show. Other ones that you can think of that sort of gave you the heebie-jeebies or –
Well, like television shows like that, I don't think they're really
– Of Twilight Zone.
Well, they just kept – ripping off Twilight Zone later on with shows like Roald Dahl's Tales of the Unexpected. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. No, I'm sorry. I wasn't clear enough. What I mean is within Twilight Zone, besides the Gremlin thing, are there other episodes that sort of knocked you out?
Yeah, I can tell you that the Buffalo 29 used to air a teaser for the Twilight Zone, which was I think it's called the 13th Floor. That was what they would show. Like, they would play the Twilight Zone music, and they'd show all those mannequins going, "Marsha, Marsha, Marsha."
Oh, yeah.
That one was apparent, you know, a regular feature in my nightmares. But the one that really, and it was like a gut punch. It wasn't fear. It was, you know, was To Serve Man. I remember watching that whole thing, and that cookbook thing. I turned the show off. It made me sick. It upset me. And then my mom called me to dinner, and it was like this big plate of spaghetti. I remember that. I was like, I really don't feel like eating this, you know.
Isn't it funny, though, because, I mean, some of those episodes, I'm sure people watch marathons or they own the shows or whatever. Like, we've seen them, you know, we've probably seen them 20, 30 times each, but I can remember the first exposure and it brings me back.
Yeah.
So that's another one that I do think of, and it really disturbed me because I was like, you know, you're putting it together as a 9-year-old or whatever. And you're like, oh, that's what they're saying. They're really doing it like that. I mean, it was creepy.
Yeah.
And I remember that every time I see it, I remember sitting in the den at a certain time or when it aired. It never aired in the afternoons. It always aired at night in the Twin Cities. So it was always like 10:30 at night. Freaking you out watching this thing. That's another one. I mean, I know these are all very, very well-known stories. There's an early one that's really creepy without doing much. It's amazing how effective it is. Do you remember the one where the woman is sort of trying to catch a bus or something? Or she's driving or something, and there's a man in the back seat, and he says, "Going my way." And he kind of does his thumb. He looks like he's sort of kind of a tramp, but not really. But he just keeps saying, "Going my way." And he's got his – and wherever she goes, there he is. He's at the cafe. He's at the thing, whatever. And it turns out she doesn't realize – spoilers – that she was in a car accident and she died.
Right. Okay, yeah.
You know, get on the bus. We got to go. We got to get to the place. Yeah. But she's completely confused because she's still in that sort of – netherworld, not knowing if she's alive or dead.
Yeah,
that really creeped me out. I mean, that was freaky scary. There's another great one. There's one that where Rod shows up in it. Do you remember the one with Keenan Wynn? He's a writer.
Yeah, and then at the end, Rod gets his comeuppance, right? He pulls out like the Rod Serling tape.
I love
says,
that one.
Rod. Yeah.
Goodbye. There's one that I can't talk about Twilight Zone without mentioning my mother because she wrote the remainder of the episodes that Rod Serling didn't write.
Under her pen name, Richard Matheson?
She went under Richard Matheson. Well, you know, she couldn't get work as a female writer back then, so she went by Richard Matheson. There's the episode with Burgess Meredith called Time Enough at Last, and he's a complete dink. Hates people and stuff and just wants to be with his books. And of course, something terrible happens. And when he comes out of the bunker, he's got all these books and no one else is around. Finally, I've got time to read all these books without the bothersome element of humans. And then he falls and breaks his glasses, his big Coke bottle glasses. And this is before LASIK eye surgery, by the way.
Right.
And can't read. Well, she would have a recurring nightmare because my mother is a voracious reader of, mysteries and science fiction and all kinds of stuff that nobody was reading. Nobody in her circle was reading Dune, in the early 60s. And she has she'd have a recurring nightmare because of that episode that she – something similar. She had all these books and it was her house or whatever and she couldn't find her glasses or she broke her glasses. So when we finally got to that series of action figures and made Henry Bemis, on the back of the packaging, I put a little message to my mother. It's down by the copyright just for her for that.
That is fantastically awesome.
That's pretty – I thought, thanks, man. That was pretty cool. I said something like – 2TML, may you never run out of books to read and may your glasses never break. Love, JL. It's on the back of the packaging for the Henry Bemis.
You know what? I'm going to go right off the rails. And I talked to a former Mego designer by the name of Vinny Baera. Okay. And he said, go get a – do you have the Starsky and Hutch figures on the card? And I said, yeah, I do. And he goes, look on there and you'll find VB – plus, I can't remember the woman's initials. He goes, that was my girlfriend at the time.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. How many people know that?
Well, I did publish that, so
oh, you
a
did.
Few, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Anyways, that's neither here nor there. That's
another one that – I mean, when you think about it, it got to a point where, yes, everyone was sort of expecting – the twist, or like, well, there's only like 2 minutes left. Where are they going with this thing? But it never wore out its welcome. It's amazing how many of those are still, there are some that land with more of a dull kind of a.
Well, there's some clunkers, there's clunkers in every episodic television
that's right.
show.
And some endings work better than others. Do you remember Redford? I mean, just if we go through the roster of famous faces that were in the show.
Well, you got Shatner, Nimoy, Landau,
Takei, George Takei.
Oh boy, Shelley Berman in one of my favorite episodes.
Carol Burnett.
Which is Carol Burnett.
Robert Redford.
Robert.
Telly Savalas.
Oh, Jack of course. Burton, yeah.
Lee Marvin. You know, it was a who's who of fame. You know, Mariette Hartley. I mean, there's loads of
Charlie things. Bronson.
Charlie Bronson. He's in a great one. It's Charlie. And who's the woman in that? Do you remember the woman?
I do. She's strangely like an exotic, beautiful woman. I can't remember. Right? I don't know if she was famous.
Hmm.
But I do know that now you've got me.
It's not Mariette Hartley, I don't think, but it's someone of that ilk, like right around.
Was she famous? I always thought, like, I remember looking her up once, and I didn't think she was. It was called Two. That's right.
Right. It's like they're on opposite sides of the
Oh, how insane! I wouldn't recognize Elizabeth Montgomery.
Elizabeth Montgomery. That's who it was.
Yeah.
Pre Bewitched.
Yes. Montgomery. Yeah, that's a beautiful episode.
That's a great episode. We're just talking about famous faces. Redford, Carol Burnett, something just popped in them. Oh, you know who else is in one of them? Joseph Wiseman.
Yeah.
And I think it's pre-Dr. No. Joseph Wiseman played Dr. No.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a year or two before Dr. No, and he's in one of the episodes.
Robbie the Robot made several appearances.
Robot, that's right.
As did the footage from Forbidden Planet in several episodes. The saucer was just, you know, they sometimes did it upside down and backwards, but it was always...
I'm glad you brought up the saucer, because that's another one of my all-time favorite episodes. The monsters are due on Maple Street.
Yeah, and you know what? I want to address this for 2 seconds, just
sure.
Because I want to put it out to the readers. When I was a kid, the local library had a pocketbook, and it was Tales from the Twilight Zone, and it was these wonderfully illustrated stories. They were comics, and they were adaptations of the Twilight Zone. So oh. The ones I remember in the story are the one with Bill Mumy. It's a Wonderful Life. Is that what it's called? Or It's a Good Life?
It's a Good Life.
It's a Good Life. And the monsters are due on Maple Street. And what really bothered me was I had read the story before I actually saw the show. It's just one of those things, you know, you're waiting for syndication. And when the monsters are due on Maple Street, I think it played in a marathon on a long weekend. And I waited all night to see it. And the pocketbook had changed the ending.
Oh, no kidding.
Because, you know, comics are able to show more special effects. And so, I'm putting out a call. If somebody knows what the name of that book is, tell me. I want it back.
Mm.
Two, the ending, I believe the ending, Monsters Due on Maple Street is one of those things my friend and I still joke about to this day. Like, the light's on over there, you know. you know, but...
Well, just to recap for people that, in case they forget what this one is, it's a nice little, you know, not a gated community, but sort of a nice little. Everyone's got a white picket fence, and they're all kind of, you know, neighborly, and they're, I don't know if they're out having like a barbecue. Well, I don't know. I forget how it kicks off. But
I think it's a 4th of July type weekend.
4th of July type weekend, and Sheriff Lobo.
Yes, Claude Akins.
Claude Akins is the lead actor. I think Jack Weston might be in it. I forget who else is in it. But basically, there are these new neighbors that have moved in, and someone gets the ball rolling. You know, like, what are they? They moved in middle of the night, and you never see their lights on, and da 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 da. And somebody gets sort of the idea that there might be something shady about said characters. And it goes from there to, you know, complete paranoia and violence and everything else. And, you know, Akins is trying to keep it together. Like, come on, what are we all getting crazy about? Like, wait, I don't know if they're cannibals or, you know, whatever it is. But someone had seen a flying saucer. That's what sort of kicks it off. Like, someone thought they saw something, and the next thing you know, they think these people are aliens. You think it's over because someone kind of, you know, finally says, well, what's the moral of this thing? Like, everybody relax and shut up, go back home. And then you sort of pull back further away from the little street, and you see a couple of aliens talking to each other, and they're saying, you see what you have to do? All you have to do is flick a few lights and turn some lights off and make some funny sounds, and they'll start killing themselves. Yep. Like, we don't even need to do much. All it takes is a little seed.
And it's a brilliant allegory for McCarthyism, which is lost on a lot of people because we didn't grow up in that era. But,
yes.
You know, and that's that. Having had family who lived in Nazi Germany, that kind of stuff is really easy to believe.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and your neighbors telling on you and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Speaking of Nazi Germany, he didn't get to go fight the Nazis.
Yeah, right? He was. I remember he was kind of upset that he had to go to Japan.
He's Jewish, you know.
Being a Jewish fella, he wanted to go fight Hitler.
He wanted to pull a Captain America and, give Hitler one in the jaw.
Well, he did because he got to use Hitler quite a bit on Twilight Zone.
He did. There's a Dennis Hopper.
Yep.
There's a Dennis Hopper episode that has to do – right? Am I wrong on that? Isn't that a Nazi kind of thing?
I think so. There's another one where the guy gets three wishes and, you know, it's one of those monkey's paw type stories where – every time the genie gives him his wish, there's a string attached, and one of them is I want to be a powerful leader, and I think the wish makes him Hitler at the in the bunker.
Speaking of, again, going back to the way this show could jump around and play with any sort of format, time travel, science fiction. Do you remember the one with Russell Blah Blah, the professor from Gilligan's Island? Yeah, what's his name?
Now I can't remember. Any other day I could just rhyme that out. And he just passed away.
He did. I shouldn't have called him Russell Blah Blah. But he was either something Russell or Russell something, right?
His name was Russell.
He was the
Russell Johnson? Is it just Russell
Mulcahy? He directed Highlander. So he goes back and somehow goes back in time to the Lincoln assassination.
Right. His name is Russell Johnson.
Russell Johnson. And he's going back, and no matter what he does, Lincoln gets killed. It's just like the futility of, time travel and the way that they're a predestined thing or whatever it is. It's pretty heady stuff when you think about it. But there was nothing he could do to prevent the assassination of Lincoln. It just was going to happen any which way he went back, I think. I think that's how it goes. He tries it a few times.
He's actually I'm on Wikipedia. I know. He played a time traveling professor in two episodes of Twilight Zone.
He didn't.
Yeah, he did. It's a bit like, have you ever looked up the internet movie database of Dolph Sweet? Remember the lovable dad from Give Me a Break?
I remember him.
Look at his IMDb. It's like sergeant, captain, policeman, sergeant, captain.
Well, that's interesting because very much like Law and Order or any of the Law and Order shows, that you can look those up and you'll see a lot of the same faces, 3 years apart. Twilight Zone did do that. They did double dip. Shatner is probably the most famous example of coming back. Did Mumy do two or just the one?
I don't know.
Remember
the one.
Little bit of trivia about Mr. William Mumy.
Yep.
Good pals with Mark Hamill.
And Miguel Ferrer.
And Miguel Ferrer.
Yeah.
But even more so, and I didn't know this until fairly recently, a year or two ago, he had a band with Bill Mumy. Bill Mumy and Miguel Ferrer had a band with some other folks that would play San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah.
This is, 20 years ago, probably, or more. And it was called Seduction of the Innocent.
Oh, cool. After the Wortham book.
Yes. That was the name of their band.
There's a brilliant photo floating around. I think I'm friends with Bill Mumy on Facebook. We aren't real friends, but
he'll love the show.
Yeah, there's a brilliant photo of him at like San Diego Comic-Con in the early 80s. Uh-huh. And it's him sitting on a couch with Mark Hamill, Bob Kane, Miguel Ferrer and Jack Kirby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's like,
that's cool.
I don't know where to geek out on this. I mean,
that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
Well, even further with the trivia, little known footnote fact for Twilight Zone, the second or third incarnation of the Twilight Zone. So
yeah.
it came back in the mid 80s. I think it came back again. And then it came back like in the early 2000s.
Actually, I can tell you right now.
The one that Forrest Whitaker hosted.
Yeah, that was the one that was done, I think, filmed in Vancouver for the UPN network.
It must have been like early 2000s, I think.
Yeah, it was. I remember watching it. They never quite got the recipe right again.
No, again, it's testament to just how smart the original show was. And they did an episode with Bill Mumy as the same kid, but as a grown man.
I saw that one. That was excellent. Yeah.
It was pretty good. And his own daughter
has the powers.
has the powers. But it's his real life daughter. It's Mumi. I think it was Mumi's real life daughter that was.
An actress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not a bad follow up. It's kind of fun to see.
Well, you know,
and
what?
Cloris Leachman's in it too. She was in the original one. Right?
I forgot all about that. That was a pretty good follow up. They did of course that CBS series in the mid 80s, and then I think the low point for Twilight Zone was just like Canadian Airwolf, there was a Canadian made season or two of Twilight Zone, and replacing Serling as the narrator was Robin Ward, who is a Canadian actor. He was on that television show, The Star Lost. Up until recently, he was a weatherman.
Wow.
On Canadian television. And my friend actually worked with him.
I never understood the Forest Whitaker thing. Nothing against Forest Whitaker, but I just never understood. There's no way to not compare whoever's going to have that role with Rod Serling.
I think it's just thankless. Like, as long as you don't put Willard Scott in there, you can't win.
Yeah. You're up against
it. You make it worse, but you can't, even if you have the best possible host, it's an impossible thing to fill. Rod Serling, you know, he personified that thing. So
yeah.
You're not going to win. And well, I thought CBS chose wisely in the mid 80s to not even have an on-screen host.
Yes, that's true. It was interesting enough to bring it back, because I think that was about 85. So it's only 2 years after the movie came out.
Yeah,
but there must have been sort of on people's.
How do you feel about that movie?
You know what's funny? I've got all of Night Gallery and I've got all of Twilight Zone, and obviously everyone knows Biff Bang Pow has made lots of Twilight Zone stuff. I've never owned Twilight Zone the movie.
Yeah,
and I don't exactly know why, because there's good stuff in it. There's definitely good stuff in it. The Lithgow, obviously, is the standout. I think it's one of the single best things Lithgow's ever done.
I would tend to agree with you on that. Of all the pieces in that, the Lithgow one is and who directed that? Toby Hooper?
The Lithgow one was. Yes, I think it was Toby. I think Landis did the Vic Morrow one.
Yeah.
Spielberg did the
Kick the Can.
Kick the Can. And then the other one was Joe Dante did
that.
Yes,
Joe Dante did that, yeah.
Right. He did the Bill Mumy redo.
Yeah.
I don't
love the film. I don't hate it. I don't think it's an abomination. I just, you know, I don't know how. Maybe I just find it uneven. I'm not sure.
I think what it is, what always struck me about it was how ugly it was. It's a really ugly movie. Like the tone is very dark. You kick the can, you get some relief, but for the most part, it takes what was already creepy and makes it super creepy. And it just always struck me as kind of violent and dark. Nothing against violence in movies, but I don't know why it never really turned me on. But one of the things I wanted to say too about Serling, now that we're kind of talking about it, is I'm not the encyclopedia of TV. I don't know this for certain, but it's kind of remarkable just what a celebrity he was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that he was well known enough because of the Playhouse 90 stuff, especially Requiem for a Heavyweight. That was a big deal, and I believe. Was it Jack Palance in the? Because they eventually remade it with someone else, I think. But I think Jack Palance was the fighter in that one. But who else can you say? I mean, these days everybody knows Gene Roddenberry is the guy, the Star Trek. But he's synonymous with Star Trek. But it's not like the bulk of that thing came out of his brain, the series, the scripts and everything. But, these days people know Aaron Sorkin, and they know, if Sam Mendes does something with – like the writers and creators are much better known now, I think. But at the time, it was really kind of radical that you had the guy that writes and creates the show doing the wraparounds. It's just a testament to just how well-known he was, how popular he was. And well known he was to have that kind of clout.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, like the only other creative person I can, like, you know, there were There were some creative, but I would say it would be Hitchcock used to host his own show. Yes. He was a character unto himself.
Yes.
But you usually got shows like, I think one of the shows, it's less remembered, but things like Thriller with Boris Karloff.
Right.
You know, and Karloff, of course, was famous for his horror career, not for writing.
Yeah, no, and there were probably loads of writers that people kind of were aware of, but probably didn't like follow their stuff. But you know, Serling was that character. So the show is it's on the time that it's on. It's a critical success. It's a rating success. There are times I think when it's bordering on cancellation towards the third or fourth season. I think the fourth season really was not as highly rated. They went to the hour format and it didn't really work. It comes back for a fifth, and then Serling's kind of done. He's done it. But he gets Emmy awards, and there's one version of events that says, you know, never was a guy so praised and lauded, you know, in a field, and then sort of dropped and unceremoniously like Serling was.
And he foolishly did the same thing that Gerry Anderson did at the outset of the series ending is. He sold the rights for nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Anderson did that with his shows too.
Yeah.
And he got a cash payment and that was it. And,
yeah,
you know, huge mistake in hindsight.
Yeah. And he was probably getting bored of it and maybe wanted to sort of escape from it. But you know, we can't give you his entire life story in the show, but some remarkable things start to happen. Like it's, I think it goes into reruns, and it's kind of, well, by the time you get to the early 70s, late 60s, and we'll get to, you know, Night Gallery, the show is taking on another life, I think, in the way that comic books kind of were. It's taking on another life with like students on campuses and stuff. They're really digging, you know, Twilight Zone, and it's sort of getting a second life, which leads to other stuff. But in the meantime, he starts talking more to studios and film projects. And I can't remember all the ones that he sort of dabbled in, or they sort of wanted specs, or I don't know what. But from most people, kind of, I think, know this, or maybe if you don't, this will be a nice surprise. The most famous thing that he put his hands on was Planet of the Apes. When it was in early days of production, early stages, he had written a script that was very, I think, that made the ape society more technologically advanced.
Yeah, I think he was writing closer to the Boole book, which, you know, the Boole book would really speak to Serling because it really was another allegorical. You know, they're using this Planet of the Apes really to talk about man.
Right.
So, you know, that's pretty much what probably appealed to him on it. But of course, I think the thing that he's famous for, and the ending of, I hope I'm not spoiling this for anybody.
I was just going to say, major spoilers here, yeah, for anyone, yeah, that hasn't seen Planet of the Apes. But the one thing they say, and you'll know this better than me because you're much more of an apes expert than I am, the one thing that remained in all the other drafts that they kind of jettisoned most of what Serling did because the budget would have been...
Yeah, it would have been through the roof.
The one thing that remained in all other drafts is his ending. I don't think that's not in the book. That ending is not in the book.
Oh,
correct?
No, the ending, first of all, Boole's Planet of the Apes in a nutshell is actually another planet.
Uh-huh.
And the character that is, it's not named Taylor, but let's just call him Taylor and Nova. At the end of the Planet of the Apes book, they jettison off that planet. Land on Earth and are greeted by a ground crew of apes. So actually, Tim Burton's monstrosity is more accurate to the Boole book than the classic film.
Okay.
But the twist end, it has a twist ending.
Oh, the book does.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because the film is actually someone is floating through space and finds memoirs, starts reading the memoirs, and at the end you realize that the person reading the memoirs goes, "Oh, that's a silly fantasy," and he's an ape.
Oh.
Yeah.
So based on a true story.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Well, I think at least 99% of the people listening right now have seen Planet of the Apes. and know what the ending is. We don't need to say what it is, but it's again remarkable to me that, I mean, if you meet people that are sort of casual fans of Twilight Zone or Serling or whatever, they may not know that. And when you tell them that, it sort of elevates him to another level, because it really is one of the genius endings.
Oh yeah, and it smacks of him.
It completely smacks of him. It's like one of the most effective things in any fantasy film or any just, you know, genre, but any film at all. Like, you know, everybody has tried to you know, in one way or another, in some of those types of endings, capture what he did in that. Because I mean, do you remember the very first time you saw that?
You know what? I saw Planet of the Apes in such a weird roundabout way that I already knew the ending.
Oh,
so,
you did?
Yeah, I think I may have seen Beneath before.
Oh, really?
So Beneath opened. Well, yeah, you're a kid. You know, you don't get a choice on when you see Planet of the Apes. And, I, you know, we can do a whole Planet of the Apes show, but I think I also saw, like, the show with Verdon and Burke and the cartoon first. And
okay.
Then the movies. So I'd watch one movie and go, well, where are Verdon and Burke? And, like, you know, you're six. And I actually had, a friend of my parents' older daughter explained the whole trilogy to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think it's funny because I have recollection of the animated series and the toys, certainly.
Yeah.
Which means, and I'm almost 100% on this, that the first Apes, the Heston, you know, the very first Planet of the Apes, I saw before I saw anything, which would mean I must have been 5, 6, 7 years old. It might have even been pre-Star Wars. I don't know, but it was definitely on television.
Yeah.
And I was mesmerized. I remember two things about it. Three things. One, I began to have a slight obsession with Roddy McDowall. Like, I loved him so much in this movie that anything he was in, you know, Poseidon Adventure, Night Gallery, whatever, I had to watch.
Well, in the 70s, you must have been thrilled.
Oh, you kidding me? He was
because it seemed like every show I like, they had him play an evil scientist with androids.
There's
like it was like they got a government, you know, mandate from Gerald Ford that said, hey, slow down.
I swear. And it, you know, it's funny, and no one ever talks about this. I feel like Anthony Daniels channeled some Roddy McDowall in what he did with C-3PO.
Yeah, because I can see some of that.
Roddy McDowall was a very particular type, and he played, you know, he wavered here, he wavered there, but he... You know, he began as a child actor, and he still had that sort of innocence sometimes, but it could border on sinister, or just he's the good pal that does, you know, whatever. But number two, I remember being disturbed by Heston's naked buttocks for a number of reasons. One, because it was one of those things that you didn't think you'd see on television. I didn't think you could show something like that. Mm-hmm. And also because there's a – you know, Apes is a kind of a disturbing movie. There's
oh,
some...
sure. It's trying – it's fish out of water.
It is not a fun. He does heroic things and he gets to kick some ass, but he gets the shit kicked out of him in that movie.
And you know what? If there's something that Serling maybe still kept in there is Taylor feels like a Twilight Zone character. You know, he's a bit of an anti-hero. He doesn't like man. You know, there's a little bit of that in there that always feels like that may have been left in there from an early Serling script as well.
I would totally agree with that, yes.
Yeah. What's the word? Misanthrope.
Yes, definitely misanthrope. And definitely a trait of a lot of Serling's characters and writing. I think it was also the vulnerability. Like, when they stripped him like that in the court. It really disturbed me as a kid because it meant that he was just a piece of meat, essentially. He just was like – he was so mistreated in this thing. That's always disturbed. Yeah, it really disturbed me. But of course, the ending, it just it didn't give me nightmares. It's just one of those things that I thought about for days and days and days and kept going back in my little kid head. Of, you know, rerunning the movie in my head and what it all meant. And it was – it just knocked me out. You know, the next time I was knocked out was The Empire Strikes Back. I was one of the lucky people, lucky kids that did not read the adaptation, did not read any newspaper, did not hear from the kids in the schoolyard. I got to see it without knowing where that was going and just punched me in the stomach.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that well, and we'll get into that in our Empire episode.
Yes,
but
we definitely will.
I remember where I was.
So right around there, the ape, I don't know if one led to the other, but I think because of the reruns and the activity that Twilight Zone was getting at the time, that suddenly another network was looking at Serling to do another anthology show. Anthology shows were getting pretty popular again, I think late 60s, early 70s sort of things. Yeah. Even things like Love American Style, you know, it's those, you know, two stories in an episode or whatever. And so I forget how this went exactly. I don't know if the original concept came out of his brain or was someone else's, and the end result was there was a show called Night Gallery, and it kicked off in 69. I think there were three seasons, maybe four, but I think three seasons. And he was the wraparound host again. He instead of being a half hour episode anthology series, they were hour long episodes, and usually there were two to three stories within the hour. There was a time where it was a straight ahead story, very Twilight Zone ish, and then there was a short that was about 10 or 12 minutes that was more comedic, and then there was another straight ahead story.
Yeah, I've never seen, like, I've only seen the syndicated package of Night Gallery with, well, there's a brilliant film, but then I've only ever seen the syndicated. Apparently, that's butchered.
Okay.
And then they, of course, because Night Gallery did not run as long as Twilight Zone, they took an unrelated series called The Sixth Sense that starred Gary Collins and mashed it into Night Gallery. So you got like this, you know, this kind of uneven bag of shows. So I've never seen those full Night Gallery episodes in my life, to be honest with you.
That's interesting.
I know that Serling signed away creative control and then really regretted it. I know that
it,
about it.
I mean, it's unfortunate because it's hit or miss. I mean, nothing achieves the level, quite the level of Twilight Zone. There are moments and there are episodes that are very close. They say that he had less and less to do with it as it went on. He was on camera doing the intros. Instead of him just, you know, doing an intro for Twilight Zone and then the camera pans to him standing in the location, he opened and closed, you know, all of those stories in the Night Gallery. And one of the best things, the most effective things about the show that really holds up, I think, are the actual paintings.
They're creepy as hell.
They are so disturbing. I mean, there's one that has to do with the death, you know, falling out of a balcony of a building, you know, 50 stories below. And the painting is so, it's like Bill Sienkiewicz, the comic book artist. It's like he had done it, you know, 10 years ago. It's so graphic.
Didn't somebody offer those in a magazine once, like prints of those?
There were prints. Try to find them now. Forget it. But there were commercially available prints while that show was on. There were a handful of bits that were chosen. I think one or two or three or maybe just one guy was the main artist for all of those. Maybe it was several. I forget. But some of them are just nightmarish pieces of art.
It should also be mentioned that the original TV movie Night Gallery in 69 was directed by Spielberg.
Who?
Steven Spielberg.
What happened to that guy?
Nothing. I think he's got a In-N-Out burger chain.
It's true. It was his first professional directing gig. And the one he did has Joan Crawford in it.
And Tom Bosley.
Sorry.
Don't forget to mention Tom Bosley.
I always forget to mention the Boz. One of the last things that Joan Crawford ever did was that episode of Night Gallery.
And it was it's weird to watch Tom Bosley play an old Jewish man in that one because you're so used to Mr. C.
Totally.
And
yeah.
It's you know, he's like, well, I guess, you know, and you're like, well, no, that's not how you talk.
Do you remember, now that I think about it, do you remember the show from the late 70s about movie making or special effects, and he narrated it? Do you remember that show?
Oh, sure, that Hollywood show.
What was it called?
You know what? SCTV even parodied that.
That's right.
And I've looked that up a couple of times because they did episodes on the devil and things like that.
But the opening credits of that, the last two shots, I will never forget this. The last two shots of the opening, because they do a montage of movie shots, the last two shots are Sophia Loren popping up out of the water, like trying to get into a lifeboat, and it segues right into a TIE fighter in space. Because this was right after Star Wars, a TIE fighter in space and Han Solo in the gunner chair.
It was called That's Hollywood.
That's Hollywood. And it was narrated by Tom Bosley.
And it ran 6 years. No wonder I remember.
What? It did. Oh my God.
I'd love to see that. I'd like to have a marathon of that, In Search Of's, you know, stuff I just don't see anymore. So Night Gallery, for what it was also more of a horror-based show with less content that it had less of a message or a voice, I think, than Sir, especially for the late 60s. You'd think he'd want to really get in there on some issues. And
he tried. I mean, he started having these fights with the network and things that go. But he, you know, he wrote a fair amount of episodes. He did the opening, closing, did the narration. He tapped some previous Twilight Zone writer. I think Matheson did some. He tried. And there are times where it works very, very well. The episode that always comes to mind, you know, when you look at the DVD sets, there are people like Guillermo del Toro doing audio commentary on some of these episodes and how effective they were and what they meant to them. There's an episode called The Caterpillar with Lawrence Harvey as the lead that was a short story that someone else wrote, and it is so disturbing. When you get to the final, like, you know, minute, it's like, oh my God, there's some really good stuff. The problem is, if you look at Twilight Zone, and you and I were saying, well, there were some duds, even the duds were better than 90% of what was on television. The problem with Night Gallery is, and as Night Gallery was on, it had a substantial following. Again, you know, because I think at this time, it's right on the time, I think, that Serling starts to do the college campus lecture thing too, where he's making a lot of appearances or doing things, and people want to know about the county's, you know, counterculture, the whole nine yards. It's getting a following with a lot of, you know, campuses are doing like viewing parties and, you know, different nights and so on. The problem is, the unevenness was when they went comedic, it was very, very big and broad. There's one I can think of that's the cast is Werner Klemperer and Joe Flynn. You remember Joe Flynn?
Joe Flynn.
Yeah. Well, actually,
he's always chasing Kurt Russell around on those Disney films.
We're probably going to make the monkey the vice principal. Okay, make the monkey the vice principal.
But my favorite thing of Joe Flynn ever is, I think, the Kurt Russell movie, The Strongest Man in the World.
Another true story.
Where he eats that cereal and thinks he's going to get super strong, and he's like in these creepy long johns trying to lift weights. I remember being like six going, I don't know if I should be watching this.
Joe Flynn. So it's Joe Flynn. Joe Flynn was working at a funeral parlor, and Werner Klemperer comes in and wants to plan this funeral. And you realize in the first couple of minutes, you know, that suddenly it's like, well, who's the one? And Klemperer is like, well, me, I never got a proper funeral. Klemperer turns out he's a vampire.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to the funeral and the way he wanted it arranged, the guests start to arrive. The guests start to arrive, and it's like, do you remember how cheesy the makeup was in like Buck Rogers?
Oh yeah,
the space vampire,
the Vorlon. Yeah,
the Vorlon. Yeah, that level of makeup. Like the first guest is clearly the Wolfman. The next guest is a witch. The next guest is another vampire. The next one is like, you know, Igor or whatever. But they're like, they're like the people that would have done, you know, live shows at Universal Studios or something. It's so bad and so ridiculous that it totally takes you out of the thing. And that was one of its you know, undoings. I don't know where that idea, those kinds of ideas came from. But
You know what started to really hit? That sort of schlocky mock horror was getting really into the remember Amicus? They would make these movies that were kind of as they moved on, the vampire teeth became more ridiculous, you know. And it, by the time they get to the Monster Club, which is I think their last movie, and it's really way too late for these kind of movies.
Isn't that that's like early 80s, right?
It's like 81. They've got all these punk bands and UB40 and stuff in it. But the there's absolutely nothing horrific about the Monster Club by the end of it. You know?
Oh my God. Well, that's the thing is, like, you go from, like, if that thing I just described was in the same episode as the Caterpillar story.
Yeah.
It's like two different shows.
Yeah. And
so it never really gelled, but it, you know, again, it was on 3-4 seasons, but it made him visible to another generation in a way that he hadn't been in a while. And of course he had all kinds of battles with the network and stuff. And eventually, you know, kind of walked away from it, disowned, you know, much of it. He did some more radio stuff. He did Zero Hour, but he also did something that I have not been able to find anywhere else but Wikipedia. He was the host of, I forget what this thing was called now, a fictitious, some DJ or someone had put together live cuts of the Beatles and Zeppelin and you name it, and made it seem like this, like in a War of the Worlds Orson Welles kind of way, made it seem like there was this 48-hour rock festival concert going on, and Serling was hosting it. But it was all fake. I mean, it was just – they just went from live cut to live cut. But the way Serling wrote the narration and went back and forth was if now coming to the stage, I can't believe this. But, you know – and so his some of his stuff was like, you know, welcome back to the blah, blah concerts. And you know what? The fans here are unreal. And he was kind of winking saying this is all fake, you know.
It's but called Fantasy Park.
Fantasy Park. And apparently loads of people would call – radio station going, where is this thing being held? Like, we got to go see this concert. But it was all fake. But right around the same time, I think this was one of the last things he ever did, because he passed away in 1975. We'll get to that in a second. But one of the last things I think he ever did was, and I'll let you take it from here, he had a significant, though not massive, part to play in one of your favorite things of all time. Please.
Yeah, he was, well, you know what? He lent his voice to a lot of projects in the early 70s. The Jacques Cousteau documentaries are.
Yes, that's right.
Absolutely landmark. But my favorite thing he did post Twilight Zone and post Planet of the Apes would have to be the intro to Phantom of the Paradise, which is one of my favorite films of all time.
Genius
and,
film.
And it's just a wonderful mood setting piece about Swan, who is played by Paul Williams.
We should do a Paul Williams show.
We should
love Paul Williams.
Me too. And yeah. Still kicking and still absolutely hilarious. Yes. We could probably get him on.
We could probably get him, yeah.
Actually, no, he's the president of what is that the recording artists union there.
ASCAP?
He's president of ASCAP.
Is he?
He's a big deal. And I think he got that Grammy recently. So
yeah. So Swan, I mean, we've got this movie, Phantom of the Paradise. It's a Brian De Palma film, wrote and directed it, correct?
Yeah, wrote and directed it. It's a retelling of both Phantom of the Opera and Faust. And it is Paul rock Williams. Opera.
Paul Williams.
William Finley.
William Finley plays the Phantom.
Who
Jessica
Harper, who plays the love interest.
And for me, for my money, the best guy in the whole thing, the best character.
I know who you're gonna say.
Best guy in the whole thing, Garrett Graham.
Garrett Graham, really amazing. He plays Beef, who is supposed to be kind of a parody of, I guess. You know, I'm not sure if there's something. He's supposed to be like a shock rocker, but he's supposed to be super macho, and of course, he's the exact opposite. You know,
I don't know where that came from.
It's a tour de force.
If De Palma said go this way or go that way, if not Graham, and see, they had a history, because one of the first things that De Palma did was a movie called Greetings. And it was one of the very first things that Robert De Niro ever did. There's three guys in it. I forget who the third one is, but the other two are Robert De Niro and Garrett Graham.
Yeah.
And it was 1968, I think, or 69.
Yeah.
So Graham had been kicking around, but so he had a thing with De Palma. Then the people might recognize Garrett Graham. The other thing he did that was pretty prominent. I mean, he's
Chud 2.
Which one?
Chud 2.
Was he in Chud 2?
He was Bud the Chud.
Bud the Chud. Well, I was going to say a great underrated comedy called Used Cars.
Yeah.
Which was Robert Zemeckis. I think Robert Zemeckis and what's his face that did Bob Gale. I think he had a hand in that too, that did Back to the Future. I think it was like 80 or 81.
Yeah. Is Jack Warden in that?
Jack Warden is in it. Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
I forget who the nemesis is.
It's one of those types of movies that kind of, if you had it with Slapshot and, you know, it's, yes. Yeah.
It's very of its time, and Garrett Graham is like Kurt Russell's buddy in the used car place.
Garrett Graham, for Phantom of the Paradise, you know, he's such an underrated actor. He should have done a lot more.
Absolutely.
And same with Finley, and all those guys just didn't get very far. And you know, as far as they should have. Funny story, my friend Sean was telling me, I can't remember the director, if it was Del Toro or the fellow who directed, I think it's the fellow who directed Scott Pilgrim, your buddy Edgar Wright, had written William Finley a fan letter, like basically saying, hey, I just really want to say how much of a fan I am, a Phantom of the Paradise and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And got an email back. I'm sorry, he died yesterday.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, it's I got it. I wish I had talked to him and gotten the verification of which director that was. But oh, it was just this, you know, oh my God, you know, how you know, and you know, he would have loved hearing from you and knowing that, you know.
Wow, so, that's interesting. So yeah. So Serling does
the opening narration of the film.
Yeah.
And I think he really helps make it a classic.
He really does. And then of course, you know, he dies rather tragically. I mean, he's Serling died. He was 52 when he died.
Yeah, and you know, he died and, not too far from where he lived. He was born not too far from me. I think he was either born in Syracuse or died in Rochester or vice versa. He was you know, a Western New York guy.
And he clearly it's odd because, you know, he never looked. I mean, if you look at some of Night Gallery, there are moments that it is kind of shocking that the same guy that it's only been like a decade, you know, since Twilight Zone, and he's definitely aged, or it seems like he's aged more than he should have. I think he was always pretty fit. I mean, he used to be like a lightweight boxer. He dabbled in that stuff. I mean, he never had like a weight problem or anything. But between the drinking and the smoking, especially the smoking, he was not the healthiest cat in the world. And he had had a heart attack. I think he had two heart attacks. First one was kind of mild. Then he had the heavy one. And so they bring him in to have open heart surgery. And I think at the time, we're talking about 1975 or so, it's not like, you know, I mean, open heart surgery is obviously still a risky thing, but at the time it was a bit more risky than it is now. But they felt like it was the best thing to do. And while he was on the operating table, he suffered a third heart attack and died. And that's how he died, as they were trying to save him, you know, and they were
That felled a lot of people in the 70s. I think that's how Ted Cassidy, you know, Lurch died as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's and it's shocking to think of how young he was, because that means what he achieved by 40, you know, late 30s, you know, 40, most people spend, you know, 20, 30 years trying to get such things.
Oh, absolutely.
So I've been in love with Twilight Zone, and he's a big hero of mine for the longest time. And I'll tell a quick story. Several years ago, we're you know, we've got three or four licenses going, one of which is a show on Showtime called Dexter. And I think we jumped on like the second season, and it was a long struggle with Showtime for a while, because they had never done anything three-dimensional for any of their shows. I mean, the year before we got the license at Comic-Con, they had some volunteers out front of Comic-Con handing out bumper stickers with the Dexter logo on it. We get the license and we're going to do bobbleheads and action figures, but they're really iffy about the whole thing. And long story short, by the time we got to Comic-Con, you know, some of the talent from the show showed up. The bobblehead sold out immediately. And by the following summer, they were giving signage and having the entire cast come down and anything we wanted to do. They really started – they'd never experienced Comic-Con. Like they didn't know what it was or what the value of it was and the real estate and everything else. But as we're kind of doing this, I'm looking at this other short list of properties that CBS has. And the person that we're dealing with is no longer with the licensing people that were dealing with CBS. And Twilight Zone was on the list. And I immediately, you know, picked up the phone and said, what are we talking about here? Like, if we got – you're talking all the likenesses and the creatures and the this and the that and everything. And I already started to kind of formulate an idea of what these things would look like, the black and white paint scheme, you know, what we could do. But one of the things that was most attractive about it was in how they kind of sold it to me. Was, and I'm talking about Biff Bang Pow, obviously, the you know, the toy company, was for the very first time, anybody would be able to make a three-dimensional representation of Rod Serling. You know, his likeness was already there. We knew we could do stuff on packaging. There were a certain number of images, but we were going to be able to make bobbleheads. And I think actually in these early conversations, it was bobbleheads. And within the license, we have that ability to do Rod Serling, to do a depiction of Rod Serling. So we got going, we got the license, we got moving, and I'm telling this story because I want to dispel this myth and sort of get it out there so we maybe never have to address it again with Rod Serling. We start doing these first you know, characters, bobbleheads, and one of the very first bobbleheads was going to be Rod Serling. And as we're just getting to you know, past the design stage, we get word from CBS that Carol Serling, his widow, would rather he wasn't a bobblehead. Doesn't like the idea. And I understand that, because if you don't really know what that is, it can not seem like they're very reverential. You know, they can seem like they're kind of cartoonish, and they are a little cartoonish. So I got that. So we turned that around and said, well, let's – how about if we make an accurate sort of portrait, you know, depiction of him as a statue, which would be about the same size as the bobbleheads.
Yeah.
And we actually did one. We did a prototype. I believe it was on display either at Toy Fair or Comic-Con. I forget. And it moved along, and it got an approval and everything. And then we get another word coming from Carol Serling through CBS that she – you know what? Second thought, I'd rather you didn't do anything with Rod Serling at all. Now, is it in the paperwork? You know, could we be those guys and go, well, we're doing it anyway? Probably, but we're not those guys. And immediately I said, I would never want to go there and do that or whatever.
Yeah.
But as we're talking and sort of negotiating, I then sort of played another card and said, but we've got to do something. If that's being taken away and that's off the table, we really should talk about other things. Long story short, that opened the door for action figures. And so this slightly frustrating, you know, setback opened this beautiful door. And I really thought when we started those Twilight Zone action figures that I really thought we were going to be looking at 4 or 5 Monster of the Week type things, and that was going to be it. And as it started to grow, and now, of course, we've got all these different categories like prop replicas and, you know, tins and journals and things like that. As it started to grow, it became very clear that people wanted Burgess Meredith, or they wanted Shatner. They wanted these guys that were just – people in these shows, but it was so well known and the people loved it so much that they wanted, you know, all the, you know, the non-monstery type characters. And it's really been this little gift that keeps on giving. There's a huge fan base out there, and the beauty of it was too, we weren't, you know, you never know with this stuff, you never know. It seems everything seems like a sure thing, Venture Brothers, you know, whatever it is. But each one is different, and whoever, you know, meaning you never know who's going to turn up to the party. So sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they turn up for things that you never thought they'd come out for, and then some things, you know, whatever. In Twilight Zone, there was so what always struck me as so strange was there was such a lack of merchandise for Twilight Zone in 50 years.
Well, there was the Gold Key comic.
There was the Gold Key comic. There was a board game. Everyone knows that Sideshow Collectibles did a fair amount. It did some 12-inch figures. And so when we you know, hit the ground running, people keep showing up. And now, of course, this most recent Toy Fair, we've shown 3¾-inch black and white paint action figures, retro figures for Twilight Zone. And people are just freaking out. And I love that, because not just for us and keeping toys going and everything, but it says so much about that show and how much people love that show. And what a nice, you know, another secret handshake Twilight Zone is for people, because they, you know, anyone that digs it is my friend. You know?
I can't get over, like, you know, from moderating at the Mega Museum, I read a lot of discussion and, you know, through some, you know, you guys have shown some wonderful prototypes, and through whatever reasons, some out of your control, you haven't been able to produce every figure you've wanted to.
Right.
And people are mad about it.
Yeah. You
know? And it's like, look at how many figures have come out, but they want more.
What's shocking to me was we really were tentative about the black and white thing. Like, even when it came time to do Talkie Tina, this was a conversation that, for example, you know, my business partner Jason Lab, he and I went back and forth on this for like a week. But if we did Talkie Tina in color, wouldn't it go along with if anybody else collects dolls, or if they do this, whatever? And at the end of the day, it always goes back to black and white. And I each time I keep thinking, well, maybe it's going to put people off, or maybe it's not going to work. But it's Twilight Zone is so associated with black and white that nobody blinks. I mean, it just is, you know, they don't care that they're not going to necessarily go with the rest of the action figures on their shelf or whatever, you know, or black and white Shatner might look weird talking to, you know, color Spock or whatever. They don't care. It's Twilight Zone and it's black and white. Shut up and, you know, enjoy it. So it's been really cool and gratifying. One other thing I just have to add is a funny little story. Have you ever been to the Tower of Terror? Have you ever done the Tower of Terror ride? I think there's Florida and there's Anaheim for Disney or Disneyland.
No, I always go to Universal Studios. So
well, I'm not a big amusement park guy or ride guy, but you know, for me, Disneyland is all about Space Mountain. Like, I could get in line for Space Mountain 6, 7, 8 times. Hmm. Tower of Terror is one of the single greatest rides forever. In you just drop. It's just a sheer drop, and then it pulls you back up, and you drop straight down. It's amazing, but it's a Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. And when you're waiting to get on this ride, there's a video that pops up, and the first bit you can tell is Rod Serling. And then they kind of fudge with the lips a little bit and then show you this footage of the ride. And there's another voice doing Rod Serling. It's clearly not Rod Serling. So we're early days of the license. First 4 or 5 products come out. And I get a phone call or message, a voicemail on the Biff Bang Pow line. And it's Rod Serling. I mean, it literally is like, hello, this is Rod Serling. And the guy does it for like 30 seconds. And then he kind of takes a breath and he goes, my name is, you know, so-and-so, and I'm just calling because I'm the voice of Rod Serling on the Tower of Terror ride. You know, he's one of these voiceover guys, does a lot of impressions. He did an amazing Rod Serling. I mean, it's dead on. And he left his number, and I gave him a call, and he was asking about the product. And I thought, well, you know, he's a local guy, and if anybody deserves a Twilight Zone bobblehead, you know, he does. And, you know, I met with him once for coffee and gave him the thing, you know, whatever. But our very first phone call, as we're talking, and he's asking about the toy thing, he says, you'll appreciate this. He says, do you guys still look for other licenses? I mean, are there other things you're going to be doing more things in sort of this vein and everything? And I said, oh, yeah, we're always on the lookout for stuff if it works. He says, well, my father was a film producer, and he did a very, very well-known fantasy film that I think maybe you could do something with. And he was the executive producer. It was a film called Krull. Have you ever seen that film?
Have I?
No, that's what he says to me.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, did I see the film? I was there opening weekend. I mean, that was one of those, boy, what can we see this weekend? Because there's no fantasy stuff or sci-fi. I was there for Krull, believe me. But I thought it was just hilarious. And I said, yeah, that might be one of those titles that just – it might be just a little too cult for what we're going to do. But you know, I just thought that was brilliant.
You know what's funny is my last experience with Krull was a couple years ago at Amigo Meet. I was I was the last guy to leave, and somebody had left something on one of the tables. And I said, hey, whose VHS copy of Krull is this? And I heard a voice go, yours now.
Well, it's funny because looking back at Krull, Liam Neeson is in, yep, Krull. Robbie Coltrane is in Krull. The guy with the beard who plays the lead guy is in Krull.
He played Marco Polo too on TV. Ken,
Marco Polo.
Ken Kenerson.
Ken Clean Air System. Do you remember the name of the weapon in that film? The glaive.
Right. That's, yes, what I said. Glaive.
Under every Christmas tree that Christmas.
Yep. You know what's funny? That's the one thing they didn't make. They made coloring books, and I think there's Halloween costumes on Plaid Stallions.
There are, and there was a board game. And in fact, I don't know how or why, but I once found on eBay the two little pieces in the board game, the little monster – and then the smaller little white army guy, which was the lead guy. And someone was just selling just those two pieces for like $4. And I bought them, and they're in my display case of all the stuff. I've got – somebody made the monster from Krull as a game piece in this board game. But anyway, this is probably longer than we expected to be or meant it to be. But when we talk about stuff that we love, that's what happens. So there's our Rod Serling episode, / Twilight Zone episode. He was a genius, and I don't use that word lightly.
Nope.
I think there are only a handful out there in, any of these fields, you know, music, television, acting, whatever you want to call it. I truly think he was a genius. He had talent to spare, and,
I think he changed pop culture.
He changed pop. I would absolutely say that. And not to just mention that. Putting the words Twilight Zone into the vernacular. It was a term that existed before he made it the name of the series. It was a term that pilots used about the event horizon, I think, and reaching a certain point. And it was called a certain time of day when you'd flew or whatever. So it was a term that existed before he used it. But it became one of those terms that just the original meaning went in the dustbin, because it's you can't not think of him or use that term and think of weirdness or the theme tune as well, the theme of the show, which is one of the most fantastically brilliant opening title sequences and music in the history of television.
Do you remember the brilliant, and this was a checkered season of Saturday Night Live, but when Randy Quaid did a parody when he was on Saturday Night Live of Rod Serling in the Twilight Zone, it was called Limits of the Imagination.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, the one I remember most is it's his face in space, and he's going, with this piece of tin foil, I will horrify you, and he shoves it in his mouth and chews it.
I remember that.
Every episode ended with them being in an alien zoo. Like, that was the go-to kind of twist ending.
Speaking of which, Roddy McDowell.
Yep. In that People are the same everywhere.
Oh, genius episode. Absolutely genius. I'm going to leave you with one request, Mr. Hyler.
Uh-huh.
Please find Golden Earrings Twilight Zone audio somewhere and stick that in the show. Please.
Do you remember that there was nudity in the video for that?
Do I remember?
Yeah, okay.
Are you kidding me?
What am I saying? You were my age. Yeah.
Yeah, that was material.
Indelible mark on your soul.
Say nudity. I say material, yeah. My friend.
Yeah, I understand.
So there you go. Always a pleasure, Mr. Hyler.
And you, sir. And I will see you in 30 days.
Thanks for indulging one of my passions.
Hey, no problem. It's one of mine, too.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.